Thank you, Mrs. Keisling, and I want to assure you that when Jane told me she was a little worried about how much she should present, how long before this audience, I assured her that the most worried person here today was Frances Howard, because to say all of the many things that I'd like to tell you about, Jane, would use up all the time that you came here to hear Jane deliver her address. So I'm going to be very brief, but I hope convey to you the warmth and feeling that I have for Jane and the job that she's doing for us here in Washington and as an ambassador at large. Minnesota, you know, boasts of many things. We boast of thousands of lakes. We boast of very outstanding men and women in public service. And since Jane Freeman came to Washington, I think the world knows that we can boast of not only very pretty women, as our president said, there comes the prettiest girl in Washington, but we can also boast of charming, gracious, and intelligent women. I would hesitate to give you the long list for fear I might leave out some of the outstanding women in Minnesota, but a number of them are present in this room, and it certainly gives me great pride and pleasure to be here in Washington to observe the outstanding job that some of our friends are doing. Yesterday, I was at a Food for Peace meeting, and a young man ran into me and said, "Oh, I was on the plane, and guess who sat next to me? Mrs. Orville Freeman." And with that, he got out a picture, and he said, "That's me, way in the back, just behind her." And so, you see, Jane truly is not only when she goes to the Soviet Union, when she addresses audiences in Denmark, Finland, Jane is truly indeed a citizen at large and an ambassador at large. I first knew Jane in 1942. It was then that she was about to, and I found out, did marry her husband in 1942 when he was an officer at Quantico. Jane worked here in the Office of Emergency Management during the last war for a very brief period, awaiting the time when Orville went to San Francisco and then out into the battle area. And then Jane, of course, I've known in her work in the political party in Minnesota, but I think those of you who are here and serve in so many and broad fronts would be interested to know that she has been on the Board of Family Service. She has served on boards of school committees, advisory educational committees, and the League of Women Voters. In fact, she was a dynamic force in Minnesota as head of voter service of the League of Women Voters. She might be what you call the multipurpose woman. I remember in Manila, we were talking about the many roles that American women perform and women around the world. I talked today with her husband very briefly, and he informs me that he not only feels that Jane is of tremendous help and support to him, but that he values even her policy and planning decisions. And I think that this is a whether it's policy and planning in the home, he didn't say, or whether it's policy and planning in agriculture. But I think it's very nice to have a husband say that his wife is not only a beautiful and charming attribute to him, but one on whom he relies for factors of judgment and wisdom. And indeed, she is that. Jane, of course, as you know, has been a very close friend of our families, and that is why I say it is with all the warmth and sincerity that I possess that I'd like to present her to you today. And indeed, she's going to talk to you about a very interesting subject, her trip to the Soviet Union. Jane Freeman.
Thank you, Fran. After that, I know I should sit down and shut up. It's marvelous, except that now they expect so much. I'm really just thrilled to be here with all of you today. I can't tell you how exciting it is, except that Well, you know how it is if you're going to talk in front of your husband. The only worse thing than trying to say something in front of your husband, I mean, unless you wanted him to hear it, is to be talking in front of a group of friends and acquaintances and all kinds of people that you admire just tremendously and that just petrify you, really. And so if I seem more tongue-tied than usual today, it's really because I'm afraid of all you experts. And I'm really not any expert. I'm just here under the sponsorship of an education committee that felt that we ought to get educated and knew that I was the kid that they better start on. I really do think this is a cheap thing, frankly, that when we think about Russia and the Black countries, that comes to mind, to me at least, as the foremost problem, both on our side of the fence and on their side of the fence, and that is that we desperately need more education about one another. I was amazed at the amount of curiosity and interest that the Russian people had for us and for our way of life, and horrified at the lack of information that they had about us and our way of life. And so I realized also that in spite of a good deal of listening and reading and talking with people, is that I did not understand very much about their way of life. So I come to you here today not as any kind of an expert at all, really, seriously, I'm not. I've been there once, I was there for 18 days, I haven't even read half the material I was supposed to read before I went, not to mention the two-thirds of the material I haven't read that I was supposed to read after I came back. So I'm really no expert at all. The only claim to fame at all that I had is that I went with an unusual kind of a group of agriculturalists, and you know, the agriculturalists are not always the people that you hear from. They're usually busy, you know, digging in the soil. By the way, I want to say that Ms. Van Allen has done a prize job for us today. Did you see this? The donkey is carrying the sheaf of wheat and the doves of peace. I can't think of anything more symbolic than you. I went on this trip with my husband, as I said, and these 9 agricultural experts, and my only expertise was that I'm supposed to be the consumer, which I am, and I do all the shopping in the family. As a matter of fact, when my husband was asked by a Russian woman in the market, he was asking her all kinds of questions about prices and things, and she said, well, how much do you pay for those tomatoes at your house? Well, he didn't know. Where's my wife? You know. So that was my only expertise, really. The one thing that I came back feeling about more strongly than ever, something I feel strongly about here too, and that is one must not judge a country anywhere by its capital and its leading city. I resent it when people judge the United States by New York and Washington, great as they may be, and I think that we ought not to, probably to judge Russia, from what little I've seen, by what we see in Moscow and Leningrad. They are really not completely typical at all. We had a wonderful opportunity to see a good deal of different parts of Russia. We were really only 2 days in Moscow, and the rest of our 18 days were spent in faraway communities. And I brought along a little diagram. It's much too small for you to see here. I will pass it around if anybody's interested in taking a look at it, because it shows you a little bit of where all we did go. And just to explain to you a little bit of the kind of area we went to. We went first to Moscow, and then we flew way out to the Ural Mountain area, to a farm area, to Orenburg. The mayor, when I say mayor, it's like our mayor, it's the chairman of their council, because they don't have any single official like this, you understand, in Russia. Their mayor said that we were the first Americans who'd been in that area since the Hoover Relief Commission, which came there just after World War I, and the first Americans that they had seen. We visited on a farm there that was 150,000 acres of wheat, straight wheat. It was some of the wheat that was growing, but not harvesting as well as one had hoped, as they had hoped, as you can read by the headlines every day now. And then we went from there down to Tashkent and Samarkand, which are down on the border, the way southern border, near China and Afghanistan. And then went over to Sochi on the Black Sea to a resort area, then up to Krasnodar, which is a very rich corn-growing area, much like our Iowa and southern Minnesota. I can't always give Iowa all the credit for that corn, you know. And then up to Kiev in the Ukraine and to Minsk in Belarusia, where we saw lots of the machinery being built, and then up to Leningrad and back down to Moscow. So it was an extensive tour. We didn't waste much time sleeping, I might add. We did mostly flying and walking and standing in the dust and, you know, visiting all kinds of farms and things. The wonderful opportunity for me was that in addition to going to dozens and dozens of farms and farm meetings, you know, where you sit at a long table and they discuss how many centners per hectare. That's something about like bushels per acre, I gathered after listening to it many times. And whether you should plow 6 inches deep or disc 12 inches deep and things like this. I also had a separate schedule most of the time and did get a chance to visit into many schools, nurseries, kindergartens, some homes, some apartments, which was not easy to do, but I must say that this was very interesting, to libraries and museums and churches and palaces of culture and palaces of weddings. This palace term is very interesting. To all kinds of stores and shoe stores and markets and hospitals, to an operating church, to most churches which were turned into museums, quite a variety of things. And it was really a great experience. And I could go on for days to tell you all kinds of little things that happened, but I wanted just to share with you a few sort of general observations and wherever possible to fill them in with a few details and then try to answer some questions that you might have, though I can't guarantee good answers. My first observation really was that the tensions and the restrictions were much less than I expected from everything that I'd heard and had read. And I think there are many signs that many of the tensions and restrictions for visitors are lifted. I realize, of course, that we were traveling as an official group, and a welcomed official group. I think the Russians were anxious to have us come. They had sent a delegation here. It was a part of an official exchange program. They were interested in sending more agricultural delegations here. But, you know, when you have these exchanges, they have to be two ways. So they were really extremely nice about making arrangements for us to see many things. I was quite aware, however, that it was impossible any place that I was, and I tried many, many different times ever to buy a Western newspaper. I did see in the libraries the Daily Worker and the West Coast equivalent of the Daily Worker. In the library that I visited, which was a large library for a republic, which serviced all the, you know, a republic is sort of similar to a group of our states, like a large state, and this serviced all the libraries for that area. In their foreign newsroom, there were foreign magazines in the English language on electronics and radio and popular mechanics. There were no women's magazines of any kind, no news magazines, no commentaries or anything. I asked about, you know, anything else, and did they have any, you know, publications? Well, no. And I said, what if somebody wanted to see, say, the New York Times? Well, we could send to Moscow for it and see, but nobody ever, you know, wants those. I did find out in Leningrad that it was possible in the library there to see the New York Times or certain issues of it for students who had a special written card and request for information. So you see, there's not a lot of understanding on the part of the Russian people for what kind of thing you might pick up in our newspapers or magazines. There is television. It's all government run. It operates in most places at certain times of the day. We had television sets in our rooms, and remember now, again, we're officials, we assume that we were probably put up as well as anybody is put up, and beautifully taken care of, I must say. And we had television sets in our room. The one didn't work, but the other one did, but only certain hours. All programs are government programs. My husband and I were on a television show in Minsk, and it was a sort of a question and answer thing, and rather carefully controlled. However, we really could have said some, you know, bad things. I hope we didn't. Nobody told us what we could or couldn't say, but, you know, I guess they assume that you use your good judgment. But I meant you're not just told what you can't say and what you can say. Radio is used a good deal. I did see a lot of radios in almost every hotel room that we were in. We had a radio. They did stop jamming the Voice of America this summer, and we did hear it twice. So there are improvements in many ways, I think, that you can see. It's still very difficult for the tourists, American tourists, to get visas, to be permitted to go to places other than Moscow and Leningrad. You can occasionally, but it's very difficult. Things always have to be arranged. You you, even if you know the language, you must be accompanied by an in-tourist guide who really does guide you quite carefully. It takes quite a long time to arrange to be able to see a shoe store. You can't, you know, just stop in and see a shoe store. It takes a little arrangement. You can go the next day or something, and then the chairman of the shoe store is there to greet you, and you get a little bouquet, and you're shown properly. And you can't just choose, you know, which grocery store you're going to go to, just to stop in as an official visitor. I couldn't, I should say. Things always had to be arranged, which gets a little frustrating, you know, to an American who likes to just say, "Ooh, let's stop here." And maybe this was really because they wanted to show me the nicest things, or maybe because they wanted to keep my program well arranged and all. But sometimes, you know, you'd like to just plain stop. And my husband found the same thing about seeing farms. He finally, one day, coming back in Krasnodar, they'd been out all day looking at various farms that had been arranged, and really, you know, we saw a great variety of types of farms, but he really wanted to just go to one farm where things had not been arranged ahead of time and not go through the little meeting and things, just visit with the operating chairman of it. And they just said, "Well, you know, you can't do that. You're supposed to be able to, you know, be back and see Hamlet." Well, he says, "My wife will go see Hamlet. I want to, you know, go to another farm." So finally they said, "Well, you know, they won't find anybody there. It's too late." This was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, he's sort of used to Minnesota farmers that work until 9, 10 o'clock at night. And he said, "Well, you know, even if they're not in the fields, I can just talk to a few of them in the offices or their homes or whatever." And they said, "Well, there won't be anybody there. They're all in town for meetings and everything." Well, he didn't care if there wasn't anybody there. He just wanted to look around. So finally they drove the best part of an hour, during which there were a couple of stops made and apparently phone calls and things, because finally they did decide that he could go to this farm over that way, you know, not just one here, but over that way. And so they drove a little while longer, and pretty soon comes this car speeding by them, and they say, "Aha, there's the chairman. He must be just coming back from the meeting." And so they stop him on the road and they honk, and he comes up and he says, "Oh, I've been delighted to have you. I was just rushing back from the meeting. So-and-so and so-and-so are on their way. It is right quickly. I told them to come." So things were arranged, and he got to go and to have a rather informal visit. So you see, it's still a little difficult. We ran into a man in the hotel in Kyiv who'd also been very frustrated because he'd been born in Russia in a small town near Kyiv. His mother was still there, and his brother, and he'd come back all the way from Oregon and had come back to try to see them, and he'd gotten the tourist visa finally after 2 years of attempting to come, and his mother had been brought in to see him at the hotel. And so for 3 days he'd been there, and he'd seen her twice when she was brought into the hotel to see him, but he was not permitted to go out to see her. And he was really quite frustrated about it and asked my husband if something couldn't be done. Well, as my husband said to the officials, "You know, this is just so stupid of you, really. I don't care how bad conditions are where she lives. This is worse for him to go back to the United States and say they wouldn't let me see where my mother lives than to have her see almost anything that she'd see." "Oh," they said, "this is terrible. It's just, you know, some minor official that's done this. We'll arrange it and everything will be arranged." And we were notified 3 days later when we were in Leningrad that he had been permitted to go to see his mother in her home. Well, it's true, you know, I can understand the villages and the farms. Many of our farms, you know, have outhouses and very crowded conditions. They do have very poor living conditions in all the housing. And that they didn't probably want him to go back and talk about that. But it's really worse. If you understand anything about Americans or most Americans, it's worse to say you can't see it. So I'm hoping that there are a lot of these things that will be changed a little bit, that there will be some more exchanges and more chance to visit. We did find, I must say, that people were extremely anxious for peace. Many of them remembered the horrors of war. Women in the villages and the factories and everything would come up to me all the time and say, "You know, we hope you'll remember that we want peace. We want peace. We want to be peaceful with the American women. We want to know the American women." The noticeable easing of the tensions. We were in Kyiv at the time the Test Ban Treaty was initialed, which was an exciting time to be there. The meeting was interrupted, and when the news came in, and there were toasts that were drunk and everything, and everybody was quite happy. And it really made a noticeable change in our arrangements in all the other countries that we visited afterwards, because everybody was more than usually anxious to be friendly. We frankly did not see any signs of hostility anywhere we went. not any signs, and that's more than I can say for some places that the Secretary of Agriculture goes in this country. I also particularly observed that there was a great deal more emphasis on public facilities than on private ones in every facet of life. While housing is unbelievably crowded and inadequate, why, museums and domes of cathedrals and parks and fairgrounds and, oh, like the Hermitage in Leningrad and all of these places are just beautifully built. Tremendous palaces of culture and auditoriums. Palace of Culture, by the way, is the sort of the recreation and education training center in each village. Every single village, every single state farm we visited in, every city of any side had at least one good-sized palace of culture with all kinds of meeting rooms. Every meeting room of any size, every hospital room, every nursery room had Lenin and the red flag and the hammer and sickle up in front, you know, with various kinds of potted palms and things around it. Even in the hospital room, you know, you wake up out of the anesthesia and there it is staring at you again. I don't know if I could stand it or not. I'd just say another pill, please. But everywhere they had them. They had these palaces of culture, had these marvelous meeting rooms. They had beautiful auditoriums, the kind that, you know, you hardly ever can find in a high school auditorium around here. On farm villages, just beautiful, magnificent ones. I kept thinking about our cultural center and the struggle we have here, you know, and just thinking that really, in all these public facilities, they're ahead of not only what they were before, but of what many other countries in the world are who consider themselves rather wealthy. Their buildings are well kept and well used. They really are magnificent. You go to the Bolshoi Theater, we saw Don Giovanni there. People are in simple dress, very, very little jewelry. Only three or four pairs of good-looking high-heeled shoes in the whole place, practically stopped traffic with white high-heeled pumps, you know. And crowded, and people go by bus and everything, but there's a beautiful theater. And there it is, jammed. In Krasnodar, the same thing with Hamlet, you know, a hot, sticky, miserable night, jammed clear to the galleries. And it was playing for 5 days, and they said this was the fifth day, and it had been filled every single day. In the song and dance groups that we saw in Orenburg, jammed again and hotter than Hades. How those dancers could stand those warm woolen costumes and singing and everything, I don't know how they could stand it. I was in a little thin dress and dying, but jammed and crowded. So you see the emphasis is a little bit different, and it's hard for us sometimes to remember, you know, it's awfully hard to judge the differences in people's desires and needs, I think. They have camps for their children, and yet in the children's camp, when I saw each little child has a little thin bed, and they're lined up one right next to the other, and their suitcase, I tell you, I would like to have seen my daughter after this. The suitcase was smaller than this podium, and about this high, and that was the child's total equipment for 2 weeks' stay at camp. You know, you remember what you send your kids off to camp with? And yet, all their kids do go to camp. The transit systems and buses and all are really quite adequate. There just really are almost no private cars. Cars take 4 to 6 years' wait. They cost between $5,000 and $6,000, and they're discouraged. They have a rental car system now that you can rent cars if you can afford to for a short time, and this is to help relieve the pressure on the government to permit more cars. I saw quite a few times people in truckloads, you know, an open truck going in from the small villages and from the farming communities going into towns to buy. I was told that you are permitted to do this usually a couple of times a year. And yet at the same time, they have all these other facilities that we don't have, you know, in a lot of places for our people. So you have to think about, you know, sort of the comparisons of what people spend their money for. I did find people were much more prosperous than I expected to find from everything that I'd read and heard. They're certainly not undernourished. They're considerably hefty looking. We certainly never starved. We had, frankly, too much food and vodka and wine. I could tell by the way our traveling companions from Moscow, there were 6 people who traveled from Moscow with the 12 of us Americans all the time, plus usually 6 or 8 people from the local community who traveled with us at all times, so we were well looked after. You could tell by the way they went after the food, particularly the fruits and the sweets and things that they were not used to this and were just, you know, really thrilled at the meet. That they weren't, even these top people were not used to this kind of banquet all the time. Their diet, for the most part, is potatoes, bread, cabbage, onions. There are very few fresh things, almost none in the winter. And even in the summer, in the big cities, there are very few fresh things. Some notion of the costs of food will give you one of the ideas of how difficult it is. In the summer, as I say, you can get tomatoes. You buy them on the street from little stands in the cities. They're not in the regular grocery store. Tomatoes, 20 to 30 cents each. Cucumbers, about that big, 10 to 15 cents each. Apples, 15 to 20 cents each. Peaches, which we found only in the Tashkent and Samarkand area, 10 to 20 cents each. Melons, beautiful big melons, but 3 rubles, which is a ruble is $1.11, you know, so that's fairly expensive for melon, I would say. Coffee, 2.50 per pound. Eggs, small ones, 10 to 12 cents each. So people, you know, usually bought an egg or two eggs. Chickens live, you know, on the hoof, and I mean really alive, $1 per pound, you know, and then you tie it with a string. You don't have any paper bags or any paper napkins. Well, paper products are practically non-existent. Only one hotel that we stayed in the total had a piece of stationery in the drawer. You know, so you carry things home from the market, you know, the chicken alive and wiggling, or you put it in your string bag and then you throw in a few potatoes and a few, you know, onions and whatever on top of that, and then you carry this. Watching the people waiting for the bus at the end of the open market was really a scream. You know, my pictures didn't turn out of that, but it was something, you know, here they stand with their wiggling chickens here and the babies here, you know. I mean, girls, we have got it good, believe me. You come back to that supermarket and you wheel around that basket and you load it into your car and you go home. Oh, it's quite a difference. But they aren't really undernourished. They aren't starving. Even if we don't sell them any wheat or give them any wheat or they don't get any of our wheat, they aren't going to starve. They've pulled in their belts before. As a matter of fact, they've lived on a lot less food before, and they can again. I think the interesting thing is that they're now willing to spend their gold for wheat, which shows you something about some changes. I feel sure. Their clothing was really quite adequate. A lot more gay colors, for instance, than I saw in East Berlin a few years ago. Plainly made, almost no undergarments of any kind. Shoes poorly made and extremely expensive. Little simple, very simple sandals that I don't think would have lasted my children through half a summer, not mention a whole one. $12 a pair. Flats, you know, just plain little flats, sort of plastic ones, $22 a pair. Heels with no particular styling, from $22 to $50 a pair. You can see why the white pumps stop traffic. The only pair I saw was in a bridal store for $50, so I couldn't have bought them for that, I'll tell you. Winter coats that are sort of what I would call equivalent of $50 or less coats here, you know, a plain, simple, straight winter coat. $85 to $110. Dresses, quite simple ones, cotton ones, $22 to $50. Really, prices were quite fantastic, I thought, in it. In the food thing, it varies a little bit. If you go to the open market or the farmer's market like we did in Kyiv, which is where they sell the extra production, this is what the farmers grow on their private plots, or where the cooperative farms, there are not very many cooperative farms left in Russia, most of them are state farms, and all state farm production goes into state stores. The cooperative farms must sell a certain quota of their production to the state stores, but what they raise over that, they may sell in the open market. Prices are carefully regulated on everything by region, and there are about 6 regions that they're divided in across the country, and whether you buy the food or clothing in one of the bitty little country sort of general stores, or you buy it in the big city store, it's exactly the same price in that region. Some advantage to our system, I think, maybe. The best produce, however, seems to find its way into the open market and the farmers market, even though they're rather carefully supervised, and supposedly the prices are the same as the those in the state stores. The better quality things do find their way, and I understand that there are quite a few various means of selling them for a little more than the stated price, which means people find out about all over the world, I guess.
But the meat is carefully inspected and graded by government experts in those, and they really do very close supervision in these open, free enterprise, competitive markets. You know, your body gets so confused about these terms because, you know, open, free enterprise, competitive, and democratic, and, you know, words like that mean one thing to us and a little bit different things to other people in different places. Back to the clothing, in a dress shop in Krasnodar, I saw the most interesting thing. There are very few ready-made clothes, very few. They have a lot of what they call half-made dresses, and that's a sort of a sack arrangement that's just sort of basted together at the waistline, and the hem is basted in, and then you come in and you try it on, and if you sort of like that color of material and that sort of general cut of the sack, then it's fitted to you, and the fitting is done in the store, and really you get it the next day, a lot quicker than you can do around here, I might add. And it's free, which is better than you can do around here. But this cotton sack will cost you from $22 to $50, fitting free. I guess they can afford it. The styling is really quite plain for the most part. I did see a style show at an agricultural exhibit in Moscow. It was very interesting. It was quite typical of many sort of high school home economics class style shows that you might see in this country. The models were very trim, the fanciest hairdos I saw anywhere in Russia I saw there. But I did not see many of these clothes anywhere outside of Moscow and Leningrad. The trimmest, most neatly dressed women that I saw anywhere were the guides in the museums in Leningrad and Moscow. But outside of those two cities and a particular group of people even in those two cities, you just didn't see it. In Gum, the big department store in Moscow, where you see lots of things in the windows, and then you go in the store and you try to buy those, well, there aren't, most of them aren't to be bought. In the stores all over, this was true, that things that you saw in the window were not to be bought. They could be ordered and you might get them. However, for the most part, you were to wait until they came in. They expected a shipment shortly. And there was a shipment, as I saw happen, of sweaters in, and you go and you wait in line until it's your turn and you say, I'd like that sweater. They say, all right, fine, that costs $12. Then you must go over across the store to the cashier's window and buy a slip that says, you know, that you can get $12 worth of sweaters. And then you come back and you wait in the line again, and then you get up there and the sweater's gone. I know this happens because I did it. And then they say, and I say, well, don't you have any more like that? No, they didn't have any more like that. No more in that size. So, you know, things are just not very available. The sizes and the colors, you just don't have any choice. As Allah, my little guide, said, you know, if you see something you want, you better get it right now. You might have a long wait till you can get it again. This she was telling me and explained that I better buy the sweater now if I wanted to get it. Fabrics you can buy by the yard goods. They're quite expensive compared to our costs. Most people do sew at home. Twice I saw this arrangement, which I thought was quite handy, that you buy your fabric and you choose the style of dress that you want. There are not too many choices, but you know, they're various size sacks and arrangements. And then they'll cut it out for you right there. So you go home and all you have to do is do the sewing. And this would really save quite a lot because patterns are very expensive and scissors are hard to come by and very expensive. So if you, you know, and especially those big sharp ones, so this helps a lot. Household goods are really very difficult to come by. Refrigerators I saw in the store were $75 to $80, the little 4-cubic-foot style, which was the only style I saw, either in a home or in a store. But those are 4 to 6 years wait to get one. Little portable sewing machines are $70 and up. Vacuum cleaners around small tank type, $70 to $80. I saw them using a little hand vacuum in the hotel up and down the halls and things. Like that. No freezers at all, no home freezers and no home dryers, and no freezers really in most of the restaurants, they told me. They have some frozen meat now and some frozen fish, which they get into the stores in the winter time. In the furniture store, I saw an interesting thing. You know, you buy a mattress for your bed at home, not inner spring type, but you know, this kind, and then you get to carry it home on your back. Because they have delivery service only if you buy the whole set of furniture. If you buy a dresser or a bed or something that you can't carry home in your back, women get to do the carrying, by the way. If you got something that you can't carry home in your back, why, you can hire a truck, one of the government trucks, and then that comes, or you can try to get it into a taxi, and if it gets a little mashed up or a little scratched getting home, why, it's kind of tough. But that's the way it is, you see, because we don't have all this delivery service. Now, when you compare these costs that I give you, which don't sound really so fantastic in dollars, with wages, then you get some notion of what the total income. It's still terribly difficult to compare, you know, what people have to live on, what they have for different things. But this gives you some notion of the prosperity or the comparative prosperity. These are all per month wages. For a good teacher, this is like a secondary school teacher, $110. I transpose the rubles into dollars as much as my arithmetic would work. A skilled factory worker, these are mostly men, by the way, $110 a month. Some of the top scientists, $200 a month, though apparently some of those go over that. Waitresses and milkmaids, $70 to $80 a month. Food store clerks, $70. Clothing store clerks, $80. Cooks in these great big cafeterias and in where most people do most of their eating, 100 to 200. So you see, if you go to Russia, you really should learn to cook first. Street sweeper, which is what, you know, more women get to sweep streets than get to teach or be scientists, $50 a month. They have, however, some extra bonuses of various kinds for extra production. The emphasis is entirely on production. Everybody must produce. The greatest hero is the man who, you know, turns 10 extra screws that week. And, you know, they get medals and they get their pictures taken and they get sometimes a trip to Moscow and everything. And then they get all these capitalistic extra bonuses, which is, you know, sort of shocking in a communist state. But these capitalist ideas have crept in here and there, particularly in the farm producing areas where people didn't really produce as much as they might have, except on their private plot they did. When you think about these prices and their total income, you have to also remember that their rents are about like $250 to $850 per month for their apartments, which maybe isn't too much when you get the idea of how big they are, but this includes utilities. Your medical care is all free and a very small cost for medicine that you buy. So it's awfully difficult, again, to compare these things. Luxuries are very few and far between. Perfume and hose are $350 a pair for Lyle hose, so this is why you don't see people wearing hose hardly ever. Handkerchiefs and things like that are quite expensive. These sheer summer dresses that people wore, you could, you know, get a good look at undies underneath. And they were always quite plain and tailored, and I thought, you know, don't they like lace or anything? Or maybe they don't believe in all those frills. Well, then I priced those that had a little lace on them, and they were like $18 for a slip. So I figured I'd wear the plain ones too. Lipsticks are, for instance, are more available than they were. There are four or five shades that you could buy in a perfumery. When I went into the perfumery that I was taken to, it was arranged and everything. There were about a dozen lipsticks on the shelf, and I could pick my choose among the, you know, the 12. And I thought about the rows and rows we see in our dime stores and drug stores. So you see, it's not that lipstick costs so much. It's about $1.50 a tube. It's that, you know, you don't always have that $1.50 left over for lipstick. Beauty parlors are quite rare. My one short experience was, well, slightly disastrous. Housing is, you know, I read in the Soviet Woman magazine, you all have seen that, I'm sure, some of you, you know, and it's all in English, and it tells really about how, you know, great it is in Russia for women these days. And it said about a great big article that said we have an apartment for each family, that's what we plan to have, and we're working on it, and almost everybody does. Well, it's not quite that way. In Moscow and in the cities, the apartments are terribly crowded. In Minsk, which has been completely rebuilt now since the war, it was, you know, absolutely leveled. You just saw rows and rows and rows and rows of these concrete slab apartment houses, all, you know, exactly like, dull as could be, but at least there was some new housing. And I thought, well, you know, this isn't too bad. They've done quite a good job rebuilding since the war. Until I landed in Dusseldorf, you know, and you get a little comparison, and then you think, well, some people have done better than others. Most apartments are one or two rooms. The great majority, like 80% or so of the apartments, have a shared bath and kitchen with other families, between four and six families. The newest ones have two to three rooms and often have a small kitchen and a little bath or a half bath, which is more likely to be a half bath, you know, just the stool and the wash basin, and then the showering is done centrally. This happens quite often in hotels, I found out, too. A little difficult, you know, 18 of us came in from the hot fields, dusty and dirty and dry and everything, and you have a half hour for everybody to get ready for the big banquet, and you and the men and everybody else have to use the same shower. It gets so complicated. But that's the way it is, and if you're more used to it at home, it probably wouldn't be so hard when you're in a hotel and traveling. I did have two wonderful chances to visit. One was the apartment that was used by an interpreter. This was her apartment. It had two rooms, and she shared the bath and the kitchen with five other families. Her family consisted of herself, her husband, and a little girl. When they got married, they moved in with their parents, because you can't get an apartment until you are married, you know, and you have proof that you're going to be a family. And so then they applied, and 2 years later they still didn't have any apartment, but then she got pregnant. So then she applied again, so hoping that they'd get a two-room apartment when they did get one instead of a one-room. But the thing was that you can't apply for the third member of the family till it arrives. So she applied again after the baby arrived, and finally, after the baby was about a year old, they got the two-room apartment, and they still have that same two-room apartment, and they've been on the list for a three-room one, you know, ever since the baby was born. Well, ever since they got into this one, and the baby's now 9 years old. So they still have hopes. One of the men who's sort of an agriculture expert who went from the United States and who's quite sold on the business, and he married a Russian girl who lives in Moscow, and he was in Kyiv, and he was explaining that he really would rather be in Moscow with her, and that he could, you know, do his expert work there, but that he could get a better apartment in Kyiv. He had this two-room apartment there, and it was a new apartment house, and he did have his private kitchen and half bath. And that, but she was still living in Moscow because if she moved out, her mother couldn't keep the apartment that they had, and she and her mother had a prize apartment because it had one room, but it did have its private kitchen, little kitchen cubby hole, and half bath, and it was in downtown Moscow, and really, you know, an apartment like that you couldn't come by. Well, you know, you listen to all this and you just kind of are confused. I visited it in two farm homes that were very interesting. One in near Kyiv on a farm, a cooperative farm, where the minister had been explaining that we really plan on a home for every family, because farm families particularly do like to have, as he said, individual housing for each family. That farm families are somewhat different than city families in this respect. I didn't know it, but anyway, that was it. They had a tiny little living room. There was the inevitable picture of Lenin, which had been carefully needle-pointed by their daughter. A rack of paper books and magazines, which I thought was interesting. Quite a nice-sized dining room with a big table, and they had a lot of their paperwork and all there, plants. The kitchen had an old-fashioned wood stove, like some of you may remember, at least I know they used it in the Middle West. It's a wood stove that also has a hot water tank alongside it, you know. So if you build the fire, you can cook on top of it. You have the oven beside for baking the bread, and you're heating the water all at the same time. But they had really quite a nice arrangement. They had a two-plate burner, butane gas burner, that was for summer use. They had a table on which a lot of food was and was covered, one open shelf for storage, no sink, no bathroom. This was one of the about two dozen new houses that were being built for the families on this farm, which they hoped everybody would have eventually. They had two bedrooms upstairs that were really very, very neat. I've never seen a house look cleaner and trimmer anywhere. The other home that I visited in the farm was in the Adamovsky farm in the Urals area, out in this great big wheat, 150,000 acre wheat place. This whole new frontier area, this is the new lands that Khrushchev got them to plow up. It's sort of like grassland that's been plowed for raising wheat, and has been really quite successful and quite productive, though is entering, we hope not, a whole long stage like we had in our grasslands of dry periods and droughts, but could be. However, this frontier area was settled. They used army tents and army trucks and everything to bring people from all kinds of cities all over the country out to be the new pioneers. And many of them, of course, left after a year or so, didn't like the new frontiers, but many of them stayed. And just like in Washington. And in this mayor's home I visited, which one would assume would be one of the best ones, there were three rooms, a kitchen which had an electric refrigerator. And I thought this was very interesting. By the way, electricity was on every farm and every village we went into. Isn't that interesting? They've done that mighty fast. Electric refrigerator, and the only home that I visited in that had electric refrigerator, way out there on the frontiers, from the tent to the refrigerator. And there was a bedroom for the two children and the grandmother with three, you know, little single kind of iron beds. And one sort of, they don't have any built-in closets, by the way, not even in the brand new apartments that I saw that they have built-in closets. They use, you know, those cupboard things and a cupboard there. And then there was another room that was sort of the parents' bedroom and the living room that had the couch sort of beds, two of them, and these, oh, these tremendous big pillows that they used. I love those. And table and four chairs, had a radio, had a chest which was used also for the dresser, and had a buffet with a glass top that had the glassware. And when she brought me in to rest a little bit and stretched me out on the bed and brought out the mineral water and the glasses. Almost always in Russian homes and in Russian, in offices and everywhere, you're served either mineral water or vodka and wine or chai, which is tea, which I became very fond of. They make marvelous chai. Anyway, in this frontier town, I thought it was very interesting because it was the first time, that was the first home that I got into, and this was the first time that they had actually been building the little houses and had started out building individual houses for individual families and had quite a lot of rows of those. Some people were still living in tents. Most of the people were living in barracks-type places. These are the people who were working those big wheat farms. And this was the only place in Russia that I saw anything that looked to me like any form of discrimination against any group. I saw a group of adobe-type huts over in the edge of the town with oriental-looking children playing outside. Very scrubby, dirty, awful-looking things. I've seen some things like it here, too. But I wondered, you know, if this was a separate slum. I might add here also that one of the interesting things was every nursery, every kindergarten that I visited in and looked at the toys and the play equipment had at least one black-faced doll. But I saw only two black-faced people in the entire country. There were two African students visiting. I must say that I think that the Russians are attempting to teach their children to accept all colors. However, they were very sensitive to any discussion of Chinese or of Oriental. My husband was a really meanie. He said to one of our guides, just teasing him, he said, one day riding along, he says, "Where did that Chinese general come from?" It was a Russian soldier dressed up in lots of ribbons and things, but he had a little bit of Oriental face. "Where did the Chinese general come from? You should have seen him, the minister and everybody just jumped right through the ceiling." They were just terribly sensitive about this, and all the little yellow dolls apparently weren't around. One camp that I visited in had very carefully, the dark dolls, but did have a little fountain that the children had built several years ago, and it had a Cupid white and a Cupid black and a Cupid yellow holding up the fountain. That was the only sign of the yellow. But they are attempting to do this. Well, I'm taking much too long, and I wanted to answer some of your questions, but I do want to just tell you a little bit. Medical care, I must say, they have, if it's as they say, and if it's what I saw, the best coverage that you can imagine, really, compared to what they had, and do have widespread coverage. It's not real good medical care in the hospitals, but the polyclinics in the neighborhoods and in every nursery school, in every school and every factory, do give you preventive shots. I think they do a tremendous job of preventive medicine. The Moscow hospital that I visited in really was not too clean. The slabs on the floor, the tiles on the floor were loose, even in the even in the operating room, which sort of gave me the shivers. They weren't doing any operations when I was there, but I thought, you know, here comes the surgeon with his knife, and then he slips in that tile. Oh, well, I cut the wrong place. But And they do have a few practices that we've sort of outgrown, mustard plasters in the hospitals and cupping and leeches and a few things like that, which made me shudder a little. But at least people can go into hospitals. There aren't any private rooms. Only one in the three hospitals that I visited in had any private rooms. They had four that were used for post-operative care. Most of the wards have 6 to 8 to 12 people, beds just, you know, almost like this next to each other, with people just recovering from an anesthesia, you know, and then other people sitting up talking. I thought it'd be a little gruesome. Nurses' uniforms never were clean and starched. I was really quite shocked at this. They do a lot of training on the job for nurses. Most of the nurses, it's not really considered a profession because, you know, if a woman wants to go into medicine, she can be a doctor more likely. They really don't train them. You have 8 years of school and then you have 2 years of sort of vocational training and on the job in the hospital and studying to be a nurse. In education, where the Russians make the greatest claim, and frankly, I think have made tremendous strides, at least from everything you can read of what they had previously. However, you know, some of the claims that I'd read and heard didn't quite bear up, you know, from what you saw. They have nursery schools for practically every baby. The baby goes into the nursery school at 6 weeks. The mother really is required to work. The mothers don't have the kind of problem we have, you know, about whether I should work or shouldn't work and whether it's best for my family or not. If you're going to eat, you work. Because very, very, very few men have enough money, earn enough money to support a family, even a wife and a child. So everybody must produce. If you don't produce, you don't eat. People who are beyond production for medical reasons or old age are kept sort of alive on very small pensions, but those who produce are the ones who eat. So mothers get a 12-week maternity leave. You know, you can plan that 6 weeks before and 6 weeks after, and then you go back to work. The maternity leave is with full pay. However, if you want to stay out with your baby, you know, and cuddle him for another 3 months, you may do this and get your job rights back at the end of the 3 months. If you stay out longer than 3 months, you know, your baby still needs you or is sick or anything, you may not stay out. You may stay out, but you lose all job rights, which in the Soviet Union is just tragic because you start from scratch again, and it means such a long way up. Babies in the nurseries are cared for from either 7 in the morning to 7 at night and fed all their meals and all of everything, so that all the mother does is take them in the morning and pick them up at night and has no other care for them. Or you may take your baby to the nursery and have them from 7 on Monday morning until 2 on Saturday afternoon, you know, day and night. And then you get to enjoy your baby over the weekend, as they explained to me. And it's really quite nice because then, you know, mother doesn't have all that care at the end of a hard day's work. She maybe doesn't want to see the baby anyway, I don't know. I mean, you know, well, these things confuse you, you know. Most of the babies in the nurseries were swaddled, you know, wrapped carefully, and this sort of helps to keep them quiet and submissive. Everything, seems to me, is helped to keep you submissive and regimented in the schools. The kindergarten schools for the children 3 to 7 have children, you know, lined up in little rows, and they were so quiet, I couldn't believe it, you know. You go into the classroom or into the nursery room, and they're all playing there on the floor with toys and everything, and it all looks quite normal, but it's all so quiet. It's just deadly quiet. I mean, there were days when I would have liked that, but, you know, when you see it time after time in nurseries and kindergartens, it really bothers you. They have quite a good arrangement for the kindergartens, the playgrounds in some of the nurseries and kindergartens. Instead of having one great big playground, you know, with swings and everybody screaming and yelling at once, they have it set off in little sections, like little play yards with shrubbery growing around, and then there's this little sandbox and a little playhouse and a little swing, and that's for one group of 20 to 30 children, and then right next is another little play yard. And it was while I was visiting in these, you know, and the children in the next one didn't know there were adults over there, and, you know, you listen and there's no noise, and I think, huh? You know, it just doesn't seem quite right. Children line up going to see sites in museums and in Moscow, and they're all lined up really quite nicely, and nobody ever gets out of line and asks questions or jumps around or anything. It really was, you know, as I say, maybe it's nice, but it just horrified me for this regimentation. As they said to me, quote, we want our children to be taught how to live closely together without friction. Well, following the leader, they are doing this. But I kept thinking, you know, what if the leader is a more warlike Mr. K than right now, or a Hitler or something? You're all well regulated and set to follow the leader and do whatever you're sort of told to do. It's the thing that horrified me the most and frightened me the most. I remember Mrs. Roosevelt talking about this after she came back, and she said, you know, it's like Pavlov's dog, and I thought, oh, she's exaggerating. She isn't. It's really true. And it isn't just true, you know, with the tiny babies. Grade schools go from 8 to 14, you go into it 7 years and go from 7 to 14 years, 8 grades. And most children are required now to go through they're all required through the 7th grade, and in most areas through the 8th grade. And then they take examinations, and those who can pass very stiff examinations go into the gymnasiums and prepare for college studies. And they have to take these at the end of each year, by the way, to stay in. Most of them go into vocational type schools, and this is where they train their nurses, their teachers, a lot of the teachers, particularly for the grade schools, their agronomists, a lot of the engineers and technicians. This is again where we get into trouble. You know, you hear so many engineers and technicians and agronomists, and I think of an agronomist, you know, who's gone through the School of Agriculture at university. Well, it's not necessarily so there. You see, it's a different term. They have a lot of boarding schools, which I thought was interesting, even on state farms. And I said, well, you know, why do children come to boarding school here? It was a high school age group, junior and senior high school age group. And I said, why would they come to boarding school? You know, they don't live so far. Well, maybe the mother, you know, has other children and the mother's working and all. It's easier for the mother. And I said, well, you know, how do you decide which ones? Well, you know, those children who need a little more training than they're getting. Finally boiled down to that apparently the boarding schools are used, particularly, interesting, the two places that I was taken to visit them were on cooperative farms. You know, the stress is away from the cooperative farm because that's got a lot more individualism left. And I gathered that, you know, where children come from a sort of a problem family that doesn't always, you know, understand about how things are in the new society, why, then the children are encouraged to come into the boarding school because you get, you know, 24-hour training there. The training really is just, it's there every minute of your waking hours from morning, you know, from age 6 weeks. The universities have terribly tough exams to get into. They have no tuition and they have some books furnished. They have some stipends, but I found out in talking with some of the people about, you know, your children in college and all, that it isn't all free like I've been told. It's true that there are no tuitions, but, you know, you do have to pay room and board. You have to live somewhere. And many of the parents, you know, the mother was saying, well, I'm working, I want to help my child, or my child is working and going to the university. The great majority of the students, I found out, really actually work part-time and go to school part-time. So it isn't quite, you know, as we're sometimes told. I was absolutely shocked at the lack of history, government, and economics trainings in the grade schools, in the high schools, and even in the universities. I asked time and again, because this was my interest, you know, about what kind of training you got. Well, we get ancient history of Russia and you know, Greek history, Roman history. No, but our ancient history, you know, back in the Tsar days and everything, and then all their own modern history, and they get ancient European history. No American history of any kind, no American government of any kind until the college level, and then, you know, not generally, only for those students particularly interested in history and all. I thought, good night, no wonder they don't know. I said, well, you know, how do people know about the Western Hemisphere and all? Oh, where'd they get all that geography? So in geography, you learn about, you know, how democracies in the Western Hemisphere work. And economics, no, not until college level, and even then, a very limited amount of study of any other economic system other than their own. It's horrifying, really, you know, because how can they understand another way of life? Again, I say, we know much too little about Russia and its background and the communist system and their language and all, but the lack on the other side of the fence is really just appalling. These palaces of culture and these summer camps and all the various arrangements that they have for the children staying in school mean that the children are actually taken care of from early morning until late evening for the most part. I think it's quite clear that family life is pretty well broken down, that there is very little family life. The mothers and the fathers eat at least two meals a day where they work, their big meals in the middle of the day. There are tremendous cafeterias, and as they said, you know, it saves the mother all that trouble of all that cooking and everything. And of course, if your kitchen facilities are limited, well, this would be difficult. But, you know, I have one of these old-fashioned notions about, you know, the kitchen being the center of the home and the dinner table being where you have influence on your children, and, you know, if you don't talk to them at the dinner table, when do you and all? Well, they don't have to be bothered with all that time-consuming sort of business. And children really are, quote, very well trained in the schools. And I was convinced that they probably were very well trained in the schools. Well, I've gone on much too long, and there's so many other things I'd like to talk to you about and tell you about. You know, women can be have all kinds of jobs in Russia. They can be doctors. They are, like 80% of the doctors are women. But, you know, 99.5% of the street sweepers are women. And the hod carriers and the concrete slab layers on the roofs of the buildings and the people who shovel the cement off the trucks, they're all women, too. And you know, you really can be almost anything you want to be. You can be a milkmaid or a shear sheep or pull the weeds around the vegetables in the gardens and everything, but, you know, you can't really get the tractor driving job that pays more on the farm because, you know, men need those jobs. Yeah. And there are a lot of teachers and a lot of scientists. I saw almost every school and nursery and all that I visited in was headed by women. Only a few men who are heads of schools, even on the secondary level. However, though their constitution explains that in government that about a third of every Soviet council on every level is made up of women. I could find out only about one woman in the cabinet. In one of the five republics we visited, there was a woman who was a minister of culture. There was one financial secretary out in the New Lands area. She was a rough, tough character, and she passed out the money for, you know, schools and things. And I figured you'd do well if you got any out of her. They probably knew what they were doing there. There was never a single woman on a single one of the councils that ran a single one of the farms that we visited on. Not one ever. At almost every one of those council tables, the only women were Mrs. Jacobson, who's my husband's assistant, and myself, and a woman interpreter very often, but never a woman in the councils running the farms, which I thought was interesting. Now, maybe they do in other places, but not the ones they took us to. Never a top woman in agriculture, either on the national level or in any of the republics. There were very few wives at the banquets, only one or two, and down in the Uzbek area, sort of the Muslim tradition carried on, and several of the wives were there, met them beforehand, and they stood aside while we were served this sumptuous banquet, you know, and well taken care of and everything, and then they met us afterwards, but they didn't sit at the table, even though they're, you know, communist citizens too, and equal. But, you know, it's more equal than less equal sometimes. I must say my general conclusion is that women and children physically are much better off than they've probably ever been before in Russia, and than they are in many other parts of the world, to tell you the truth. I think that they have more opportunity for education, for camp, for seeing their own country, for cultural and sports events than they probably have ever had. I'm terribly concerned that they have so little chance to, while they're having all this education, to learn more about other parts of the world. I think they're very curious about us and they're anxious to know. I'm horribly concerned about this regimentation. The few students and artists and poets who've tried to break away and to open up and that we read quite a lot about are mighty few. They're having a terribly tough struggle, and it's not going to be easy for them. I must say that I think the most important thing that either you or I or any of us can do, in my opinion anyway, to help is to try desperately to do everything we can to get more exchange programs. In spite of the difficulties we're having as of yesterday's and today's paper, and in spite of increasing difficulties in many times, we must have them. And we must do everything we can to try to get some more women here. I encouraged everywhere, you know, several of the ministers of agriculture in the republics were planning to come on the next delegation. I said, you know, I hope you'll come too to the wife. No chance of that. You know, and I understand the difficulties. Believe me, I couldn't afford to go either. But, you know, there was a chance if I could get the money. Well, they didn't have any chance, you know. I mean, it's this attitude that, you know, it just won't happen to us. I think we must do everything we can to try to get as many Russian students, people, men, women, and children as we possibly can to visit with us, to show them as much of the everyday life of our country, of our freedoms, of our choices, as we possibly can, and that as many of us as possibly can just go there and be ourselves and look for ourselves. I just think it's really the only hope for any kind of real understanding and peace. Thank you much.
Mrs. Freeman, we are absolutely enchanted by your perfectly wonderful talk today.